Welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast where we talk about Apple news, rumors, programming, and all of our different projects and many more things. With me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
I'm doing great, John. Yesterday I woke up, I was super happy to start a new week, and I got this email from someone called John Sundell. And it said that the newsletter was ending. What's up with that?
Did I ruin your day?
Yeah, you ruined my entire week.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So, I canceled my newsletter, or I ended it. It's been 2.5 years going, and for the most part, I've been enjoying working on the newsletter. It's been going great, and I've had a fair amount of subscribers, and it was a nice project to work on for a while, but it felt that it had come to kind of a natural end at this point, where I didn't really have any inspiration to continue working on the newsletter as a form factor, if you will, because I have so many other channels to kind of express myself and to work on and to communicate and to share things with the community. I have, of course, this podcast, my website, I have the Swift by Sundell podcast. There's just so many outlets, and comparing the newsletter to all of those other things, I can, number one, reach a lot more people with my other channels than the newsletter reached, even though it was, having a good amount of subscribers, almost 10,000 subscribers, but it was still like a very small audience compared to my other channels. So it always felt like, weird to dedicate some specific content to the newsletter when it would reach so relatively few people compared to if I would just post it on my website, for example. And because I didn't really focus too much then on the newsletter, it felt like just this kind of second thing I did that was kind of not a big focus of mine. And at the end, I just felt it doesn't really pull its own weight. Like, it doesn't really give me or the community really enough value for me to continue this. I would rather just focus on the website, focus on the podcasting, and the people who like newsletters then have a lot of other options to pick from. There are so many newsletters in the community these days. So I didn't really feel like this was a space that I needed to continue working in, since I have so many other things to do.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you were doing something for a reason, and basically that reason ceased to exist, and then it no longer has to be a product in your lineup, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. And especially when there are so many good alternatives out there, great alternatives. And of course, it's good to have a variety of content from different sources. But we have these amazing newsletters from the community already. And since you were not enjoying doing it anymore and you didn't see a reason to keep doing it, it's not like you're leaving a bunch of people without an option. Like, people who liked your newsletter are certain to also like some of the other ones that the community puts out.
Exactly. Because at the end, for the past year or so, my newsletter has basically just been a collection of links to the articles and podcast episodes that I posted the month prior. And, some people had a lot of value from that, and they really liked the fact that they could kind of catch up on my previous month worth of work through the newsletter. But at the end of the day, it was all just kind of reposting content and articles and things that I already posted on the website, right?
Yeah.
So no one is actually losing anything. It's not that I'm going to stop writing articles or doing podcast episodes, quite the opposite. It's just the newsletter itself, sending out emails that I'm not going to do anymore. So that also really factored into this decision that, the opposite decision I could have made was to say, okay, let me actually focus on the newsletter here and make it really good. The people who work on newsletters, let's take our friend Dave, for example, who works on iOS Dev Weekly. That is a fantastic newsletter that is its own thing, right? He works really hard on that every week, and he sends it out, and it's its own kind of magazine, if you will, that you get on your email, a newsletter. and my newsletter was not that. My newsletter was more a bunch of notifications, if you will, that you would get by email. And again, some people really like that, and there was a fair number of subscribers, but I didn't feel very inspired by that form factor. And I didn't feel like I wanted to go to the length that people like Dave and others who work on these newsletters that are really good do, because it's a lot of work. And I would rather focus that effort and energy on the other things that I already have that are going really well, like my website and podcast and so on. So, you know, at the end of the day, you have to prioritize, you have to decide what do you want to spend your time on. And in my case, it just felt like a good decision to say the newsletter, unfortunately, doesn't make that cut anymore. I'm going to focus my energy on other things.
Yeah, perfect. And speaking of your stuff, I think it's time for another Swift UI corner, or is there something else this week?
Let's do a UI kit corner this week.
Ooh, nice.
So I've been working with the UI kit a little bit more during the past week or so, like a couple of weeks, actually. I've been working on a client project, and I was working on a collection view-based UI, and this collection view was quite complex. It had dynamically sized cells that would size themselves depending on the content they were rendering, potentially a quite large number of cells as well, different kinds of content being rendered. And I also wanted the ability to kind of have very finely grained control over the scrolling so that I could scroll to specific points in this collection view. And I've talked about UI collection view many times in the past, that it's one of my favorite classes in UIKit. It's extremely versatile. And whenever I need to build something that is dynamic in any way, like where it needs to render like a bunch of different things in the same view, and that view needs to scroll potentially, I need to lay them out in different ways, I almost always reach for UI collection view, just because I can start with all of the built-in layout mechanisms and, you know, the flow layout, for example, or now the compositional layout. And then if I need to, I can always write my own layout. I can do very, very custom things. I almost have complete control over the whole layout, and I have selection. And there are so many things that come with UI collection view, and I feel it scales really well from more simpler use cases to more kind of advanced and complex use cases. So overall, I'm a huge fan of UI collection view. Or what do you say, Rambo? Are you a UI collection view fan as well?
Yeah, definitely. I do think it gives you a lot of flexibility, and also you can kind of do, and with a lot of quotes, declarative UI in a way, after you get all of the boilerplates done, of course, but you can build up different layouts by declaring them with data, and of course you're going to have your code that actually renders the layout. And yeah, the flexibility is incredible, especially with new things such as the compositional layouts, which I do use in Chibi Studio for the item picker. That's extremely flexible, and it takes a bit of getting used to, and the API can look a bit complicated in the beginning, but once you get the API, it's actually really powerful and not hard to use.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really what I like about UI collection view in general, that it has so many different options, which makes it extremely versatile as a UI component. But what kind of struck me as I was building this, so I went all in here on the like most modern APIs. I used the self-sizing cells that lets you use auto layout to determine the size of each cell. So each cell will kind of determine its own size based on its contents. I use the compositional layouts. I use the new cell registration APIs. I use the diffable data source. Like, I used all of the new stuff, like all of the bells and whistles.
This is fine.
Yeah, this is fine. And what was interesting was that just like when using Swift UI, so I guess this is going to be a UIKit Swift UI corner. It's like right on the intersection between UIKit and Swift UI. So when using Swift UI, we've talked about this before, that it can sometimes be a little bit frustrating, if you will, or at least feeling a little bit limited in terms of how much you can customize it. And perhaps even more importantly is that sometimes it feels very much like a black box style API where you can't really see what's going on under the hood, and you basically declare your view and it either gets rendered correctly or doesn't. And when it doesn't, with Swift UI in particular, it can sometimes be really difficult to know why, right?
Yeah.
Like if you just declare a Swift UI list and you put a couple of things in your list and something doesn't render correctly, or the scrolling is stuttering or something, it's hard to know where to begin to debug that, because you don't really have anywhere you can put your breakpoints, because you are not in control of the underlying rendered UI or the layout calculations. Those are all being done by the framework. So it can be really difficult. And it's interesting because I feel the exact same way about these modern UIKit APIs. They are also very declarative, like you said earlier. They are also much, much more higher level than what the kind of older or classic UIKit APIs, maybe we should call them, are. And they also follow the same design, which is a little bit like Apple telling you, just tell us what you want to render and we'll make it happen. Don't worry about the details, we'll make it happen. And unfortunately, when it doesn't make it happen as you want to, it's the same experience of not really knowing where to begin to kind of debug this, especially with kind of the combination of compositional layout and self-sizing cells, where pretty much all of your layout happens internally in the framework. So there's really no way to know. For example, I had issues where the content offset would be a little bit, you know, a couple of pixels off, or sometimes one cell would become too large or too small and so on. And that was really difficult to debug. And eventually I actually went back to the classic UIKit APIs that I'm going to call them now from now on. I built my own layout and I was using kind of the more classic ways of doing a data source and so on. And then everything just works because I was in complete control over it. And I realized that this is also perhaps a little bit like me having somewhat more limited experience with these more modern APIs. I have used them before, and I've really enjoyed using compositional layouts and diffable data sources in other projects that have had more simpler use cases. And for that, they've been working out fantastically well. But it was just like this kind of perfect storm of all of these different technologies at the same time with this very complex layout that I was trying to render, that I just felt getting this more manual control that the older APIs give me felt a lot better and was a lot less frustrating as a development experience. So it was just an interesting point that I don't feel like this is a difference between Swift UI and UIKit necessarily, but maybe we should more talk about modern versus older style Apple APIs. Maybe that's where the difference is.
Yeah, I think this highlights something about API level, basically. And when you go to a higher level API, you most of the time you'll inevitably lose flexibility. And if you go for a lower level API, or for a more classic API in this case, you get all of the flexibility that you can, basically. So I think it's just a trade-off in this case. And of course, the new APIs might get more customizability as they progress, but they are basically higher levels of abstraction on top of pre-existing APIs, and they inevitably remove some of your flexibility.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to put it. And another thing that's challenging when designing APIs like that, because I've designed APIs like this myself as well, and you want to strike a balance between giving the API user enough customizability while also keeping the API simple, right? And if you add too many override points, then the internal logic in the framework will also get too complicated, and that just opens up a large surface area for bugs as well. So if you keep your API more limited, then you can test most of the kind of different combinations that people can create. Well, if you have a very flexible API that's very free form, then you're definitely going to have a lot of edge cases and things that are untested. So yeah, it's definitely a trade-off. But I think when I see this direction that both UIKit and SwiftUI is heading in, it also makes me wish that perhaps, maybe customizability is the wrong word, but maybe like being able to open things up and look under the hood. Like that's really what I'm looking for here, I think. And I wish that it was perhaps a little bit more of a priority, where right now, most of these things are kind of an all or nothing type of deal, where if you want to use compositional layouts as an example in UI Collection View, you can just build your layout using that system. And then if you want to customize things in any way, you either have to use something like a flow layout, which is way more customizable, which I think kind of strikes that balance much better, or you have to build your own custom layout. So I feel like it's very often kind of take it or leave it, which I wish there was a little bit more nuance there, where perhaps there could be a little bit more override points, or a little bit more points that you could kind of override something, or implement your own custom logic to inject it. I think that could be great.
It's take it or leave it, and you wanted it to be take it or take it, basically.
Exactly. I just want everything, Rambo. I just want my cake and eat it too. That's what I want. So yeah, that's been fun. And again, like, I really like these APIs. Both modern UIKit and SwiftUI is fantastic. And for the most part, it really works really well. It's just when you're starting to do those more complex UIs with it. And perhaps, you know, it's by design. Perhaps the intention is that I should write my own custom layout if I want to do something more advanced. But of course, those shiny new APIs are always there and you always want to use them. At least I do. So I always want to try with them first, and then, you know, sometimes I do end up having to go back to the older APIs, which is fine, but it just makes me wish for a perfect world where I could always use the higher level API for everything.
Yeah, it's a common issue with APIs where, like you mentioned, the take it or leave it kind of thing. If you want to do this one extra thing, then you basically have to write everything from scratch, which would be the equivalent here for collection view. But it happens a lot. Like, it used to be, I think, more common, but now it's not, with things such as codable. Like, oh, if your model maps perfectly to the JSON or property list representation, you don't have to write anything. But if there's one little thing that's different, then you have to write everything from scratch. Like,
yeah,
there are lots of APIs that are like that, and I think they are usually like that more in the beginning, but as they evolve, it usually changes things for the better and increases the thresholds between you being able to do everything automatically or basically having to re-implement everything yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of wish that curve was a little bit more smooth, right?
Yep.
That you don't have to go to either you have to write 0% of the code or 100% of the code, like that you can kind of meet in the middle there somewhere. And yeah, Codable is another great example that has been gaining a little bit more flexibility over the years, but still, I think, does not really strike that balance either. Nope. Like, I feel like if you just wanted to completely customize the unwrapping of one property, you can do that with things like property wrappers and other techniques, which is fine. But, you know, you kind of wish that would also be a little bit more baked into the API, other than just like changing the name of a key, which you can do. But, you know, it's nice when APIs have that kind of smooth curve from like the most simple use case to the most advanced use case, that you can kind of gradually work your way towards there. You don't have to like drop your entire implementation and rewrite it with a different style.
I use this thing called Code Extended. Don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah, I heard it was written by a very, very nice guy.
Indeed. So we talked about your corner now and UIKit, but I want to know more about Swift Siri, because I heard that's the hot new thing.
Right, yeah. So I did some spelunking, and deep within the Swift compiler code base, I uncovered references to a Swift Siri framework, which lets you use Siri. You can use the power of Siri to essentially write commands that Siri will interpret. Siri will act like a second compiler for your Swift code, and then generate functionality and generate even whole applications on your behalf. Pretty cool, right, Rambo?
Yeah, super cool.
Where can you learn more? Well, unfortunately, where you can learn more is in my April Fool's article for this year. So that was my April Fool's little joke for this year. I always like to write these like made-up articles on April Fool's Day. And I know that some people really don't like April Fool's Day. I personally really like it. I think it's fun to, once a year, not be super serious about everything, but, you know, let loose a little bit. And as long as it's very clear that it's a joke, and I even put disclaimers like at the bottom, like if someone reaches the bottom of the article and they still didn't really get the joke, which can happen, absolutely, then I want there to always be that little disclaimer there that says, this is actually an April Fool's joke. But I try to make it kind of very almost ridiculous, like the whole concept, and so that people will feel that it's a joke and something funny. And, you know, it's hard to be a comedian with code, right? But at least I try, and I try to just kind of, you know, do something a little bit more lighthearted once a year. So yeah, that was my April Fool's joke for this year.
Yeah, I do agree that for a successful April Fool's joke, it has to be something so like outrageous or so unexpected or funny that it's clear that it can't be true. I'm not a fan of actually fooling someone with an April Fool's joke, even though that's the name. But I don't think it should actually fool people. I think it should just be something fun and unexpected. And I also had my own April Fool's jokes, plural.
Yeah, you went really all in this April Fool's Day. It was super impressive. And not only, you didn't just like write an article or something like that, you actually built apps. Like, you actually went really far with these jokes, and it was just super amazing to see. So tell our listeners, for those who haven't seen your April Fool's jokes yet, what were they all about?
So the first one was, this was not my personal April Fool's joke. This was the one from AirBuddy, the quote company.
Yeah. AirBuddy International Incorporated headquarters. Not at all in Rambo's apartment.
Nope. So I did this feature called AirBuddy Buddies, and it's basically stories within AirBuddy. So when you open your AirPods, you see the little status for your AirPods, and below you see stories from your friends of them using AirPods. And yeah, that was the idea. But just to be clear, this is not actually a feature in AirBuddy. I didn't even implement it. It was actually kind of funny, and I remember talking to you about this because you were in on the joke, that I wasn't sure what was going to be quicker for me to do, if it was going to be to actually implement this in AirBuddy. Of course, like all mocked, not like a real stories feature with an API and things like that, just like the UI so that I could screen capture it. Or if it would be easier to do it in After Effects as a mock-up. And I had pretty much settled on it would be easier for me to actually like write code to do this and screen capture. But I ended up with kind of like a middle ground where I modified the app here locally, and I ran it just so that the status window would be taller and have extra space at the bottom for the stories. And I recorded a video of that on my Mac, and then I dropped it into a Keynote presentation, and all I implemented right. The stories UI using Keynote and Magic Move. And you can tell that the animation is all messed up, like it's not supposed to be perfect. And then I made this little video. So yeah, I recorded the Keynote presentation as a video, dropped it into Final Cut Pro, added some background music, some text, and that was it.
Yeah, I think it came off as really believable in terms of the UI itself. I didn't at all get the feeling that, you know, all the animations were wrong and everything like looked very, you know, made up. Of course, like the whole premise, like we discussed, was, you know, very silly. So I didn't expect that this was real, that you would actually add a stories feature to your app. But in terms of the looks of it and how you actually visualized it, I think that was completely spot on. I think you did a great job on that.
Thank you. And the other one was this app. And something I didn't expect is that a lot of people didn't think it was actually an app. They thought it was just a joke, basically. But I actually released the app itself. But of course, the app is a joke. And the app is called FanFan, and it's for people who are fans of fans. So if you have an Apple Silicon Mac and it doesn't have a fan, or the fan doesn't make enough noise for your taste, you can run this app and it's going to blast fan noise out of your computer speakers. But there was actually some real work done to simulate the fan speeding up as your CPU usage increases, which I'm actually relatively proud of.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone actually expects someone to implement the app that they're making a joke about in this case, right? Like, it was really impressive that you did that. And, It was also great to hear what my Mac Mini could have sounded like if the fans were running all the time. And I was very happy that it does not sound like that all the time. So could you perhaps talk a little bit more about the actual implementation? Because like you just alluded to, you did actually write like an algorithm for how much fan noise will be in there. That's like it's a very typical Rambo joke here. It's like super technically complex and it's actually a real implementation. So tell us more about it.
Yeah, so I had a limit as to how much time I could spend on this, of course. Like, this is a joke and I'm not gonna make any money out of it. And not that I shouldn't dedicate time to things that don't make me money, but you get the idea. This was during work hours, so I kind of set myself a time limit of like 1 to 2 hours to work on this app. And fortunately, it wasn't as hard as I thought it would be. I recorded fan noise from my 2019 16-inch MacBook Pro using my Blue Yeti mic, the same one I'm using right now. So I basically like pointed the Blue Yeti at my MacBook Pro and put a bunch of pillows around it so that it wouldn't capture any outside noise. And I use one of these fan control apps to set the RPM on the fan to a specific velocity. And then recorded like, I think, 30 seconds or something of that.
You could have just cloned the Swift compiler project and built it from scratch and you would have gotten the same result.
Yes. And my initial idea would be to record the fan at different speeds and then kind of like fade between the different soundtracks. But as I was editing, like cleaning up the recording for the first RPM, which was 4.8K, I think, I tried it out in Adobe Audition, which I was using to increase the pitch of the fan noise, basically. And it worked. Increasing the pitch basically sounded like the fan was going faster.
Mm.
So I thought, well, we have APIs on Mac and iOS and all of Apple's platforms that allow us to change the pitch of a sound file while it's playing. So that's what I did. I made sure that it would loop appropriately, that it wouldn't be noticeable when it loops. And I designed and developed this fan simulation engine, patent pending. And what it does is, as the CPU usage on your Mac goes up, it increases both the pitch and the volume of the fan noise. And if you are a developer and want to check it out, I actually open sourced the code on GitHub. So we have a link in the show notes so that you can check it out. Yeah, and for the CPU usage, I take like a moving average of the CPU usage of all of your CPU cores, so that like when it starts going up, it accelerates, but when it stops the high CPU usage, it takes a while for the fan to calm down, just like it is in real life. I thought about actually using the temperature, but the truth is that M1 Macs don't get hot very quickly and very easily, so it wouldn't work for the joke. And let's be reminded that this is a joke, so it doesn't have to be perfect or real by any stretch of the imagination. But I think I did a decent job of simulating your Mac actually having a fan. And of course, it only works on Macs with Apple Silicon processors. If you run it on Intel, it pops up a dialogue that says, hey, your Mac can already make plenty of fan noise on its own, and it quits.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic. It's such a good joke and also like a great implementation as well. And I was playing around with it a little bit, and it was indeed adjusting dynamically to what I was doing. So great job on that as well. One thing that did surprise me about this joke, apart from the fact that you actually went ahead and built the whole thing, which I didn't expect, was I looked at the credits that you had for the app, and it turned out it's powered by Imagine Engine, my game engine. And I was like, what's going on here? You're not even rendering any UI. Why would you need a game engine for this project, Rambo?
Well, to be fair, it's only a little piece of Imagine Engine. I needed to do interpolation between values in a temporal fashion, also known as animations. But it wasn't animating like a layer on screen or anything like that. I just needed like to change a value over time. And to do that, I usually go for a display link. And the best implementation of a display link that I know of for macOS is in Imagine Engine. And it happens to be written by this really smart guy that I know. So I just took it from there and dropped it into the project. And there you go. And that's how Imagine Engine ended up in the credits for FanFan.
That's amazing. I love it. I've actually also used that particular implementation of the display link for Mac, which is much harder to use than the display link API on iOS. You have to basically pass like a raw C function pointer to it in order to get notifications when the screen has drawn a frame, which is what a display link enables you to do. It lets you get an event basically every time the screen is refreshed, which is really useful when you want to do what you were doing, like any kind of custom logic that you want to do on a frame by frame basis, when you basically want to run a loop and you don't just want to do like a while true loop, right? Where you're putting like sleep time or waiting in there, you actually want to react to every frame being drawn. And in Imagine Engine, that's used to drive like the whole rendering of each game. But I've also used it in other types of applications where I wanted to draw something every frame or do something custom that didn't involve like just animating a view or something like that. So we'll also leave a link in the show notes to that implementation. It's very useful if you're building a Mac app that has these kinds of needs.
Yeah, definitely. So that was the other one. And last time I checked, the app had been downloaded almost 10,000 times. So a bunch of people tried it out.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. You almost should have charged like a dollar for it. You know, that would have been the best April Fool's jokes of all time. A profitable one.
Yeah.
Oh, so really cool. I'm very happy to see this. I think you did a great job on your April Fool's jokes. And I'm excited to see what you will do next year. I mean, I can't really see how you can top this, but I'm sure you'll come up with something for sure.
Yeah, I'll try to figure something out.
Awesome. But now let's move on to our In the News segment. But before we do, let's take a very quick break to thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stacktrace is brought to you by Linode, which is the web host that I run all of my website, Swift by Sundell, and also WWDC by Sundell on as well. I really like Linode, and I'm really, really happy that they're now also sponsoring this podcast, which lets me tell you more about them. So Linode's Linux virtual machines can help you simplify your server infrastructure and can cut your cloud bills in half. And it can also let you develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications faster and easier than ever before. So whether you're developing a personal project, you just want to have a server up and running for some reason, or if you're managing larger workloads like a whole enterprise-grade infrastructure, then you deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing solutions. And you can get started on Linode today with $100 in free credit for you as a Stacktrace listener. You can find all of the details at linode.com/stacktrace. Linode has data centers around the world with the same simple and consistent pricing, regardless of which location you choose. So you can freely pick the data center that's nearest to you or to your customers or any other factor that can influence what type of data center you want. You will also receive 24/7 human support with no tiers or handoffs, regardless of your plan size. You can also choose shared and dedicated compute instances, or you can use those $100 in credit on S3 compatible object storage, manage Kubernetes, and more. Basically, if it runs on Linux, it runs on Linode. And I can personally vouch for that, as I've been a happy Linode customer for several years now, and it's the place that I run all of Swift by Sundell. I run my website there, and all of the server for it, and all of those things. And Swift by Sundell gets hundreds of thousands of visitors each month, and Linode works incredibly well for it. I'm a very happy customer, so I do hope that you will check it out as well. And what better way to check it out than to use those $100 of free credit? So all you have to do is go to linode.com/stacktrace and click on the Create Free Account button to get started. Use those $100, build something, try it out, and see for yourself just how cool it is. Thanks a lot to Linode for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo. So now let's jump into our news picks for this week. And what do you have for us?
A new interview with Tim Cook. And this was on Sway by Kara Swisher. And they talked about a lot of stuff. And what I liked about this interview, and I think you would agree, is that she has a way of doing these interviews that's different from the regular interviews we get with people from Apple in general, but especially Tim Cook, because they usually sound like they've been rehearsed, and it's basically just rehashing PR speak from other announcements. But I feel like on this interview, we did get a few interesting reactions by Tim Cook that I honestly wasn't expecting from an interview like this.
Yeah, I was incredibly impressed by Kara here. And I mean, she has a track record, and she has this fantastic style of interviewing, and she always has the confidence to ask these tricky questions, even though, you know, she knows that Apple, even though she knows that Tim, in this case, might not be able to really answer something, she still kind of pushes on it. Like she was even asking about, like, so are you building a car or what? You know, like I really love that. And when I was listening to it, I was like, I could never do that. You know, if I got Tim Cook on my podcast, you know, if that would ever happen, I could never like interview him this way. Like it's not my style, but I'm just like very impressed. And I loved listening to this interview. It was absolutely fantastic, I think.
Yeah, definitely. There were a few times when I feel like he was caught by surprise. And one of those times was when she asked about AR and what Apple was doing with AR. And he said something like, well, I can't say something about a product which may or may not be in the pipeline. And that kind of says like, it's basically saying like, yeah, we have this product in the pipeline, but I can't tell you about it. And then Tim gave an example of like, oh, imagine if you and me were talking here on this show and they were talking with video probably when they were doing the recording. Mm-hmm. And imagine I could pull up a chart and we both could see it. And I guess that's going to be the main feature of the Apple AR headset. Charts.
Eye chart.
Yeah,
exactly. It's so interesting because, you know, the classic kind of Steve Jobs way, if you will, of answering questions like this would be to, like, Steve Jobs was kind of famous for, you know, completely like saying that a technology was like not interesting at all. And, you know, it was a terrible idea and it's not going to work. And then like a couple of months later, introducing the technology, right?
Yeah.
And here we have Tim Cook, like he's way more kind of political or diplomatic in a way. And he's also like not leaving any doors closed, right? It was very much like, let's leave these doors open because presumably, like you say, they are working on these things. And there's been so much smoke now around these AR glasses, like that there's probably something in the works. We can be pretty confident around that. But it was just interesting to hear him talk about these things and not just saying, you know, no, I can't discuss that. No, I'm not going to answer that. He did say that once, but then he still kind of answered the question, which again, yeah, just shows like, I, as you can tell, I'm a pretty huge fan here of Kara Swisher. I think she did a great job. And it just shows like, you know, her ability to get answers even around these questions that these executives typically just say no comment when they get asked about it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this interview was probably mainly set up because of the new app tracking transparency initiative that Apple is working on and has been working on and is now making official and requiring from app developers. So for those who don't know, this basically means that if an app wants to track you across different apps or even between apps and websites, as it used to work until recently, the app could just do that. Like apps could associate a unique identifier, a unique advertising identifier of you with your actions in that app, in other apps, and in websites. And that was usually done through SDKs such as the Facebook SDK. And now, if an app wants to do that, even if it's using a third-party SDK, the app has to explicitly ask you for permission, basically putting up a dialogue like, do you allow this app to track you? Yes or no? And I hope and I feel like most users will say no to that question. But because this is such a significant shift in how this works, there is a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubts about it. And I think the main entity that's been promoting this FUD about app tracking transparency is Facebook, and saying that it's going to destroy small business and things like that, which people always say about a change they don't like. They always come up with an excuse like, oh, think about the children or think about the small businesses.
Right.
And it's almost never true. And it almost never happens that the thing they say is going to happen if something changes happens. And I think Apple knows that this is causing a lot of discussion and they want to be ahead on the narrative that this is a good change and that they know what they're doing, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because when Tim talked about this, he was very, you know, strongly opinionated about it, of course, and he was basically presenting it as something that would be hard to argue against, that this is very much in the kind of interests of users and that users, like, don't want to be tracked, right?
Yeah.
And I think this really kind of hopefully will prove a point that if a lot of people then say no to this, then it kind of shows that people don't want to be tracked, which I think is true. And that the only reason that all of this tracking has survived for as long as it has is because it was kind of done secretively, right?
Yeah.
Or like we in the tech world kind of knew about it, but we actually haven't really been talking about it for that long, right? Like
true.
We've only been talking about it for a couple of years, really, in the kind of, you know, bigger picture, but it's been going on for a long time. And a lot of like regular people, if you will, like people who are not in tech, I think is a better way to say it. People don't really know about these kind of tracking things or haven't known about them before. So it's going to be interesting to see now when people are faced with that decision, do you want to be tracked or not? How many people are going to say, yes, please, please track me. And of course, perhaps apps can convince users that the tracking is for their benefit. There are good instances of tracking too. Like for example, I allow Microsoft to quote-unquote track me on Xbox to give me better game recommendations for based on games that I play. And that makes a lot of sense for me in that context. Like, I'm not putting like my banking information on my Xbox, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not like putting a lot of my personal data there, but I am explicitly allowing that, even though I am like, they have similar kind of consents there that you have to accept. And I was glad to accept that because of the benefit it gets me. So perhaps this first iteration of this dialogue is a little bit like pretty far in the other direction, where previously many users were not aware that they're being tracked. Now they're going to be very explicitly made aware of that they're being targeted and tracked, like the language that's being used in that dialogue. But hopefully, like over time, we can perhaps reach some kind of middle ground where if there is value to the user of kind of giving up parts of their data or being quote-unquote tracked or, you know, having recommendations based on what they're doing on a platform or something, perhaps some people will opt into that in certain contexts. But I do think it's great that users now are hopefully becoming more aware of it, and also that they get the choice. Like, not having the choice, I think, just like Tim said in the interview, I think that's hard to argue against.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's very important to point out as well. You mentioned not every tracking is bad, but it's also important to know what tracking is. Like, I wouldn't call what you're doing with Microsoft tracking necessarily, because I'd say if a given app or service is tracking users within that app or service or platform, it's very different than a huge company like Facebook, who has their SDK in pretty much every app in existence, tracking you across all apps that you use in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's very different.
And also, again, context is key. If Facebook wants to track what you do in a game or whatever, all right, like maybe that's not that big a deal. The problem is when like your bank app puts Facebook, the Facebook SDK in their app, or like a health related thing puts the Facebook SDK in their app, and then Facebook is tracking things that you might not want them to know about you. So I think there is also the fact that maybe it's going too far in the other direction, but I think what Apple's system is preventing here is a very specific type of analytics. And this caused a bunch of confusion even for developers. But if you're a developer and who's listening to StackTrace, if you have your own analytics and you only track analytics, which again, I wouldn't even call it tracking, but let's use the term for the sake of argument. If you track users within your own app and only what they do in your own app, but you don't track, use that data to like enrich data within another context, like a website or another app, then it's fine. Like the problem is when you start tracking users across multiple apps and websites, that's the problem. And of course, Facebook is the biggest company that's doing that. And another benefit of this dialogue being so like in your face in a way is that many companies and apps are just removing tracking altogether. Like they're like, yeah, we don't want these identifiers anymore, and we're gonna remove it because we don't want to put up this dialogue. Like I certainly wouldn't want one of my apps to pop up a dialogue like that at all. So if I had an app that tracked users like that, I would probably just remove it.
Yeah, and that's really the power of things like this, right? It's the same when they introduce that clipboard notifications, right? Mm-hmm. Like when the user pastes the clipboard, there's a little dialogue popping up as part of iOS, and then apps that were like reading from the clipboard on every keystroke or every time the app launches or something, they were very quickly, you know, made aware of, and also a lot of them very quickly removed that functionality or changed it in some way. Yep. And that's just a great kind of way to push the industry forward, if you will. Like I consider this forward, I consider this progress. And like I said, like perhaps in the future, in the long term, there needs to be some adjustments to kind of settle on some kind of middle ground. But I am really happy that Apple is doing this. And number one, I think it's great to kind of incentivize companies and developers to not do too much tracking. And what I would define as tracking, so you mentioned there like internal analytics, I would identify tracking whenever data is being associated with you as a user that is being kind of correlated between different events, if you will. And those events can happen within one app or within one platform or across apps. And of course, the more it is across apps, arguably the worse it is. But even like within one application, I would also like consider things that, you know, if the company can reconstruct the way you were using an application, they can basically reconstruct your session, what buttons you clicked on, what you typed into text fields, what you viewed, I would still consider that tracking, and I would still consider it creepy if it can be identified to me personally. If it's all being done anonymously and just in aggregate, and there's no kind of trace back to me as an individual doing one action and then the next and the next, then I wouldn't consider that tracking. I would just consider that analytics. But as soon as you're tracking me as an individual, whether it's just within an app or within multiple apps, I would still consider that tracking. And the more we can kind of push back against this as a society, if you will, or like an industry, and try to minimize that. Again, not all tracking is bad, but the tracking that users are not aware of, I think that kind of either needs to stop, or users need at least to have the choice as to whether they want to participate in it or not. That's kind of my standpoint.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also the nutrition labels for apps in the App Store, they contemplate that, because you have a difference between grabbing analytics and associating data points with a user ID. That's exactly something that you need to say differently in your nutrition label, and of course Apple guides you through that. So I do think that you're right there, that yeah, tracking a user session and then every action they do to a specific user identity is tracking, definitely, even if it's within just one app.
Yeah. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out in the long run. And of course, there were a lot of other like nice, interesting things about this interview that Kara Swisher did with Tim Cook. And we'll leave a link in the show notes to the full interview. I really recommend listening to it. It was really great. Just one quick thing. Well, let's see if it becomes a quick thing. But before we move on to the next topic, there was also some talk about the App Store. And one interesting tidbit there was that so Kara brought up like that Amazon Prime Video pays only 15% in commission as part of in-app purchases. And then she mentioned like that that's a special deal. And then Tim Cook's answer to that was that, no, we treat all developers equally. Anyone who runs a streaming service who fulfills these criterias can get this deal. And that I haven't heard before. And I'm not sure if the deal is like, well, anyone who builds an app called Amazon Prime Video can get this deal. You know, we treat all developers the same. It, of course, depends on how these things are written. And I don't think that any of these things are public, right?
Well, this was mentioned before in other contexts. I think in the hearing, the antitrust hearing, the same thing was mentioned, basically. But it's one of those things like governments do this a lot, and not to get into politics here, but just the theory of it is like, if you want to regulate a specific thing, but you want to give a company unfair advantage over other companies, you can basically create a regulation that fits perfectly with what a given company is already doing, but it's going to be really hard for other companies to comply with.
Right.
Yeah, so basically like, oh, which criteria could we come up with that would contemplate the existing Amazon Prime Video app? Oh, this set of criteria and like a list of 30 things that the Amazon Prime Video app does. All right, so this is now the requirement for an app to be part of this program. That's easy. Like, you're basically giving Amazon an unfair advantage without explicitly saying, oh, this is just for Amazon. And yeah, then there are like two or three other apps that can also do it because they work to get to that list of criteria, which Apple can always change. And actually, I think that's the point. Like, Apple is the one making the rules. They can change the rules. They don't have to. Like, they mention the guidelines sometimes as if they come from somewhere else, but it's Apple that's making the guidelines.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And they can change it at any point. They can interpret it as they want, you know, and so on. So yeah, absolutely. That's always important to keep in mind. But yeah, I thought that was just really interesting to kind of, because we mentioned it when those kind of initial hearings and these antitrust things started, we kind of took issue with Tim Cook's testimony at that time saying that we treat all developers the same. So I just felt like this added a little bit more context, even though, you know, you can agree and disagree with these policies and the way they run the App Store and so on. And I think both of us are at least in favor of a little bit more openness and so on, a little bit more options for developers and other people. But, you know, everyone has their own opinion on that. But I just thought that was interesting to just hear this, to just get some more context around it.
Yeah, the main thing I complained about that hearing was when Tim was asked if Apple's own apps follow the same guidelines, and he answered yes. And that's a lie. Like, that's just a lie. Apple's apps do not follow the same guidelines. And I'm going to mention it here again that I don't think they should. Like, of course, Apple's apps are going to have special privilege in the App Store, but then just say it like it is. Like, don't say that they do, because they don't.
Right, exactly. So speaking about Apple apps and Apple services, we also have some news around Apple Arcade, which is very much a very John-friendly news item here. This is something I'm very, very interested in. But Rambo, do you want to tell us a little bit about what this news about Apple Arcade is about?
I think this was the most Rambo-friendly arcade news ever, because this is actually like my thing. I'm into like older games and to some extent simpler games. So Apple added, I think, a lot of games. Like, it was around 30 new games, right, to Apple Arcade. And these are like classics like Trees, Fruit Ninja, Monument Valley as well. And yeah, you can now get these games on Apple Arcade if you are a subscriber. And I am, because I have Apple One. So I have been playing some Fruit Ninja here because that's a game I really enjoy. And yeah, I really like these news.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely. So Apple announced that Apple Arcade now has over 180 games, which is quite impressive, actually, given that it hasn't been around for that long. And like you mentioned, they are now bringing a lot of... I love that you call them classic games, because for me, like, classic games are like Super Mario and Tetris and these sorts of things. But, you know, classic, just like UIKit classic APIs, this is classic in the context of the App Store, right?
Classic
App
Store mobile classics.
Yeah, exactly. So like very popular games like Trees, Fruit Ninja, Really Bad Chess, which is a big favorite of mine, Monument Valley and so on, like really critically acclaimed great iPhone games are now part of Apple Arcade. And this, for me at least, represents a quite significant change in strategy on Apple's part, like around Apple Arcade, where previously we've seen that they have been more pursuing exclusives and they've been acting more like a producer where they've been funding game development and those games have then in turn be exclusive on Apple Arcade, at least as far as mobile goes. And, you know, they could also release the games on consoles and so on. But here we're seeing more what I would call like a almost like an Xbox Game Pass like strategy. So, over the past like 6 months or so, I've been playing a lot of Xbox on my new Series X, and I'm a Game Pass subscriber, and I absolutely love it. And what's great about Game Pass is that it doesn't just include games that Microsoft produced or like their first-party studios or companies they're partnering with. It also includes like a pretty huge catalog of other games that they've just added onto Game Pass. And here we're seeing the same thing happening where Apple is essentially like convincing companies to bring some of their existing games that have existed on the App Store for a while now onto Apple Arcade as well. So it becomes this collection of not only exclusives, there are still a lot of exclusives too, but very nice kind of well-rounded collection of popular games, games that have been there, classics, new games, exclusives, and so on. And I just feel like this change in strategy is really good for Apple Arcade, and it makes me excited for things to come, that if it's going to be a little bit more versatile and open like this, that it's not just about Apple-funded games created specifically for Apple Arcade. I feel like Apple Arcade has a much brighter future than what it looked like before.
Yeah, definitely.
So do you think that this might also happen with their TV initiative as well? Do you feel like they could adopt a similar strategy for Apple TV Plus, where they could bring in kind of a bigger back catalog into the service rather than just focusing on exclusives?
I mean, sure, yeah, that would be fun if they managed to acquire the licensing for some old things, some classics that people might enjoy. I just don't see that happening for some reason. I feel like that would have happened a while ago if that was the case. But who knows? Yeah, they might be doing that behind the scenes and we don't even know about it. But yeah, it would surely be a good thing for the service.
Yeah, I think just like with the games, I think that would make a ton of sense, and it would also increase the value of Apple TV Plus as well. Because what you want, I think, is for these services to feel like no-brainers, right? Like, again, yeah. Xbox Game Pass, if you have an Xbox, I just think it's a no-brainer to be a subscriber, because the price you pay for Game Pass is like, it works out so that if you just play two games a year that are like full-price games, or maybe three, then it's like worth it for the whole year. So it's like, it's a no-brainer to be a subscriber. And you want it to be like that for both Apple Arcade and for Apple TV Plus as well, that of course, if you have an iPhone or an Apple TV or a Mac or an iPad, of course you should get Apple One and get these services because the offering is so strong. And when Apple Arcade came out, I actually did feel that way about it. And I think we talked about it on the show, that I felt like it was a no-brainer. There was like 100 games available. There were a lot of good ones. And I subscribed immediately and I started playing. But then after a while, as I worked my way through those games that I wanted to play, and we did even Stack Trace Arcade, right, where I was reviewing some of these games,
yeah,
I just felt like maybe I shouldn't be subscribed anymore. But now with this strategy, I feel like this is something that could keep people subscribed. I mean, now I have Apple One, but in general could keep people subscribed to these services even, you know, after they finished playing that one game that they initially subscribed for.
Yeah, I think they're solving the problem from multiple perspectives there. And especially Apple One is such a good deal in most places. And especially if they come up with something like you go to the Apple Store, you buy a new iPhone, and if this is your first time, so you're basically a new Apple customer, you get, like, even if it's just like a month of Apple One for free, I'd say most people, if they actually try out the services, they'll have a hard time going back to not having it, because when you get it as a bundle, there's just so much stuff you get for that single subscription that it's hard to say no to that if you're into Apple stuff, of course.
Yeah, exactly. And what did you think of the technical solution, how they made this happen on the App Store, where, you know, it's clear that this is something they didn't do. They didn't want to, like, change the infrastructure on the App Store. And maybe in iOS 15 and the new platforms, there's going to be support for this. Because, like, again, going back to Game Pass, if you go to the Microsoft Store and you see a game there that is on Game Pass, it will say install with Game Pass, right? It will just say that on the store. But here, they actually made duplicates of all these games that already exist, and they just added a plus at the end. So what did you think of that solution, that they basically duplicated these App Store entries to get them into Apple Arcade?
Well, it's probably one of those things where there's like a is Apple Arcade flag on a given app, and if they set that to true, then if you can't buy the app separately, or the game in this case. So they probably would have to adapt the App Store infrastructure to handle the same thing being available as a subscription that you have or as a separate purchase, and something web objects something.
Right, yeah, we know that the infrastructure, like, that powers all of these stores is quite old at this point.
Yeah.
And probably not that fast to iterate on, and presumably it would also require client updates, right? Like, yep. So new operating system versions. So I get why they did it. It's just a little bit fun that you go and you see, like, trees plus really bad chess plus, you know, like, it's all just the plus at the end. So I guess, like, it's a fine solution. It would make more sense if it was called, like, Apple Game Plus, but it's called Apple Arcade. So yeah. Maybe they should have just added the joystick emoji at the end instead.
I don't think game titles in the App Store support, or app titles support emoji in the title. I think maybe the underlying storage doesn't support UTF-8. I wouldn't be surprised right. if that was the case, but yeah, that would be a solution.
Yeah, absolutely. So really interesting to see how this is going to affect, like, Apple's overall content strategy going forward. And, you know, as a fan of games, well, it seems like both of us are really excited about this addition. And I've been playing also some of these games that were added, and I've been having a blast with it. So yeah, really exciting to see overall. Cool. So now let's round off this episode with our Ask Stacktrace segment. And we have a little bit of a different Ask Stacktrace this week, where we must say that we really wish that more people would ask us questions here as part of Ask Stacktrace. And maybe you're just shy, dear listeners. Maybe you don't want to reveal your question to us, but hopefully, like, this is a safe environment that you can ask your questions in. So we do hope that more people will send us questions, because we really want them. So you can either tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace, or you can just email us privately. We don't even need to mention your name if you don't want to, but, you know, we usually just mention people's first name anyway. And you can email us at stacktrace@9to5mac.com. And please send us your questions, because we do love this part of the show, but recently we haven't been getting that many new questions. So we thought what we would do is simply ask ourselves some questions. So, of course, it would be weird if we just asked questions for both of us. So instead, I'm going to ask Rambo a question, and Rambo is going to ask me a question. So Rambo, what's your Ask Stacktrace question for me?
Yeah, I have a good one. And this is a Linguistics by Stacktrace segment now.
All right.
What's a language you would like to learn, but that you do not expect to have time to learn it in your lifetime? So a human language that you wish you could learn, but realistically, you know you're not going to learn it.
All right. So currently I speak Swedish and English fluently, and I speak Polish, definitely not fluently, but I'm getting there. I speak Polish decently, I would say. And Spanish, I used to speak pretty well, but these days that knowledge in my brain, like the part of the hard drive that used to be occupied with Spanish, has now been taken over by the Polish knowledge instead. So my Spanish knowledge has actually decreased a lot over time. And it really shows that language is something that you have to maintain, just like software.
Yep.
And the more you speak it, the better it is. And if you don't speak it for a while, you tend to forget. And that has really happened for me with Spanish. So I would say I'm not that great at Spanish anymore. I know the basics. I remember the basics, but I've forgotten a lot of it. So to answer your question, well, I still want to continue learning some languages. Like if I will ever become fluent in Polish, I want to go back to Spanish and really kind of bring that up to par as well. And I would also love to learn more kind of also different European languages like Italian or French maybe, and things like that. That would be super interesting to learn. Some languages that I really also want to learn, but to answer your question, I don't think I will manage to learn in my lifetime, are languages like Japanese and Chinese, where especially Japanese, given that I'm a gamer, there's a lot of games coming out of Japan. And back when I was younger, I used to even import games from Japan and play them with like a guide that was the translation. So I would like read from a paper what people had translated this like role-playing game, all the dialogue over to English, and I would then play the game in Japanese. That's like how much of a fan I was of these games. So I would love to be able to learn Japanese, but it seems to be a very complex language. It has, of course, not an alphabet like, you know, Western languages do. It has instead the symbols. So I think it would be quite tricky for me to learn that. But I would really love to learn both Japanese and Chinese. But I don't think, unfortunately, I will be able to fully learn either of those two languages in my lifetime. Unless I really, really try. Maybe I will. We'll see.
Yeah, it's funny because I would answer the same. That's actually my answer as well. I would really like to learn Japanese, and that's because I love anime, and then I have Chibi Studio. That's a proof that I do. And I actually tried to learn it a while back, but the problem is, like you mentioned, the writing system is just too complicated to even for like even people who are born there. They take several years or even decades to get good at the writing system. And I it's something that I always wanted, was to learn a language that had a different script than the languages I already know, which are currently Portuguese and English. And I settled on an alternative to Japanese, which is a lot easier, at least in writing, which is Korean. The writing system is way easier than Japanese, and I'm already pretty good at that. Now I just need to actually learn the language that it's writing, but I'll get there, hopefully.
One step at a time.
Yeah.
And you're learning Korean through Duolingo, right?
Mostly, yeah. And it's really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we mentioned it in passing on a previous episode, but I've been doing Duolingo for Polish now. I think I'm almost up to 200 days now in my streak. So it's been really great, like, to do that practice every day, because like I mentioned, like, keeping the language fresh, especially when you're learning, is so important. And just having that like 5-10 minute lesson every day, like, really does wonders for building up your library of words and becoming more comfortable with the grammar and things like that. So yeah, it's been really great. And learning languages is super fun. I wish I could spend more time on it. And yeah, it's really cool. It's funny because I actually have the opposite of you there. Like you said that you wanted to learn a language that has a different writing system. I feel like that is such a big obstacle for me that I would... that's why I think I'm sticking to languages that use a similar alphabet. And then maybe sometime in the future, I will try to pursue some of those other languages. It's not that I don't think, you know, those languages are good or something. I think it's super fascinating. It's just like, it's such a big hurdle to first have to learn a completely new writing system.
Yeah, that's definitely a hurdle.
Cool, but great question. Thanks for that question, Rambo. Did you submit it with a hashtag AskStackTrace, or did you email it?
This one was with hashtag linguistics by StackTrace.
Oh, right. Yeah, maybe we should start that hashtag as well. That's a good one. All right. So my question for you is that you've been doing a lot of hardware-related work lately. You've been building your own boards and your own controllers and your own little hardware. We've talked about it. You've also done a fair amount of kind of reverse engineering of Apple's hardware, like AirPods and things like that, and the communication between AirPods and iOS devices in order to build AirBuddy. So based on all of this kind of hardware-based work that you've been doing, what have you learned from that that you felt that you could apply to your software work as well, like your coding?
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah, so the main thing I would say, and not that I didn't have like an idea of this before, I definitely did, but something that was highlighted even more when working with hardware-related stuff is the concept of separation of concerns, and more specifically when you have to work with something you don't have yet, basically. And separation of concerns really helps there. And to give an example, if I'm working on a piece of hardware and I'm writing like the firmware for that, let's say I want to have a given sensor for it to drive something, but I don't actually have the sensor hardware yet. Or maybe I don't have the sensor hardware wired up to my board. I need to be able to work without having that. Otherwise, if I just wait for me to have everything ready before I start working, then I will never start working, basically.
Right.
So separation of concerns really helps there. And also like simulating things when you can't actually make them happen in real life. That's something I use all the time when I'm working on hardware projects. And it's also something I use more and more when I'm working on software projects. I'd say to go to an extreme, you should be able to simulate every possible thing your software can accept as an input. And input can be an API response or user inputs or something else. Of course, in reality, you're not going to get to 100% every time, but you should be able to simulate a bunch of conditions, as many as you can, so that you can properly assess things in real life, not just with like things like automated tests, but also like when you're manually testing things.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounded there, I was going to bring up testing, because it did sound like you were describing mocking and almost like test-driven development, but from like a hardware point of view, where it's like you're actually like missing these sensors and you have to like mock their input, and then you're testing it by continuing working on your program and having that program accept that mocked input. But it's almost like a different way of doing test-driven development, but it's like lack of hardware-driven development or something like that.
Yeah, that is a little bit like that.
That's great. Do you feel like, you mentioned separation of concerns, but do you feel in general that working on hardware has kind of improved the way you work with software as well?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's hard to quantify, but you do get a better understanding of what's happening when you work closer to the metal. And you can do the same by like programming against a lower level API, like we mentioned before. But when you are running your codes in a piece of hardware and your code is the only thing that's running on that piece of hardware, other than like microcodes or something, then you really start to notice all of the little things that things such as an operating system take care for you, which when you're writing against bare metal, you are basically writing your own operating system to an extent. And at the same time, there are also advantages because any bug is your bug. Like, it can't be a bug unless it's like a bug in the chip or something, but that's extremely rare. But so any bug you encounter is more likely to be your bug rather than like you using some API in a weird way or some API not behaving as expected.
It's funny, we're kind of coming full circle now to the beginning of the episode, right? Where we talked about how high-level APIs can sometimes be a little bit frustrating or limiting because they're more high-level, right? And yeah, they're more limited and there's more potential for bugs in the actual framework or the API itself. And here is the complete opposite. It's like all of the code is your code, which also means that all of the bugs are your bugs.
And they can also be hardware bugs if you wired something up incorrectly, or there's like a power supply issue, which I've seen before. So yeah, lots of fun there.
Yeah, absolutely. Great answer. I was really happy to hear that, and thanks for sharing those learnings. And if you want to ask your questions to us so that we don't have to ask questions to ourselves on the next episode, then please tweet at us with a hashtag AskStackTrace. You can ask us any question that you want. It can be about Swift or programming in general. It can be about tech or about linguistics by StackTrace or anything else that you would like to ask us. You can also email us at stacktrace@9to5mac.com. But now that we've reached kind of full circle here at the end, I think this is a good place to wrap up this week's episode of StackTrace. So thanks a lot for listening, everybody. And make sure to take advantage of that $100 of Linode credit that you can get simply by going to linode.com/stacktrace and clicking on that create free account button. Just to get started, you can build something on a server, you can try things out, maybe try server-side Swift. It's a lot of fun. So make sure to check them out as well, because that also really helps support our podcast. But regardless, thanks for listening again, and we'll talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.